Bruce, you're an architectural engineer, and you ascended to the top of Mount Ararat, and you've got this engineering brain, and you're thinking, boy, if I could ever see Noah's Ark, I would love to look at this thing to see how it was made, right?
That's exactly right.
Well, tell us about that, and tell us how you got involved in this expedition.
Well, through Dr. Price, Randall Price, who teaches a professor at Liberty University, and through my archaeological endeavors and with Aaron, we put it all together in 2013. And just before I went up the mountain, they asked me, if you walk inside the Ark, what would you be looking for?
Mm-hmm.
And my first thought was the connections. Is it connected with wooden pegs? You know, they have to be connected somehow, or is it some type of metal, or metallurgy?
Let's review a few engineering details. How big was the Ark? It was not just a little boat.
It's 450 to 550 feet long, based on a cubit, and there's different estimations of what a cubit was. So,
and I'm just going to pop over here to Genesis chapter 6 verse 13. God says to Noah, he says, "The end of all flesh has come before me," and then he lays this whole situation out before Noah. And in the 14th verse, he says, "Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark, and shall pitch it within, without, with pitch." This is not very much detail about construction. Somebody would love, like you, would love to just get a glimpse of this thing to see how it was built, right?
Exactly. That's what forensic architecture does, is it looks to see what's it made of, how was it made, how did it hold itself together. And when we were drilling on top of the summit through 60 foot of ice, I was telling everyone, the first thing we hit is probably not going to be wood, but some type of bituminous material, or resin, if you will.
Or pitch, as it's
in pitch King James. Pitch is what the King James says, and it says it was pitched inside and out. It's a waterproofing. That's what it is. So we knew the wood would be caught up in something like that. So that's why going up the mountain and coming down, we were excited about the possibility of finding a piece of the Ark intact, or pieces of the Ark, such as the pitch.
So you're a forensic structural engineer, and you've worked on some important structures, including, by the way, he told me, a famous structure in Texas. Tell us about that.
As the re-roofing of the Alamo.
The re-roofing of the Alamo.
In San Antonio, Texas. And so.
And I said to him, is it roofed with pitch?
It's a type of pitch. A modern-day pitch, if you will.
A modern-day pitch.
You know, most people don't know that it's a barrel roof, and you have to keep the, quote, pitch from flowing down the side of the barrel. And so we had to take all that into consideration. Of course, it's a very historic structure, so it took some forethought. With a preservation architect, we were able to get the job done.
Now, Aaron Judkins, your area of expertise and study is quite different. Tell us about your background and how you got into this expedition.
I have a PhD in biblical archaeology. I've always been interested in history and archaeology. Mm-hmm. When I heard about the search for Noah's Ark, I was intrigued because this is a story we all grew up with.
Yeah.
And back in 2010, they invited me on previous expeditions to go up. I just couldn't at the time. Time constraints, financial constraints. But in 2013, I learned that this was going to be the last major push in the search for Noah's Ark. And I was determined I was going to go. I didn't know how, but I was determined I was going to go. And since then, this whole expedition and the search for the Ark has really been, personally for me, has been so rewarding, because this is something greater beyond ourselves. This story goes worldwide to some 500 ubiquitous flood legends around the earth. So this is embedded in every culture around the world. It's an amazing story. And our job as archaeologists is to set out to find empirical evidence if there is indeed a structure on Greater Ararat in eastern Turkey. And that was part of my job.
Now, Greater Ararat, there in eastern Turkey, there's a huge mountain. And beside it is a smaller mountain. The ark is said to have landed upon the mountains of Ararat. Ararat is a volcano, or has been in the past. I guess it's still partly active. So you're climbing a rocky volcanic mountain that is how high, Bruce?
Well, Greater Ararat is around 17,000. And
that's tall.
Yeah.
That's a huge mountain. And we think of Pikes Peak as a huge mountain, and this would be three or four more thousand feet?
Yeah, the smaller mountain is the size of Pikes Peak. It's about 14,000. And it looks tiny compared to the bigger mountain, which we believe the ark is resting.
Let's spend just a couple of minutes kind of setting this up, because getting to the top of that mountain is a physical feat. And you've both told me in great detail, by the way, we don't have enough time that would take the whole period that we have here to detail the climb. But let's just say it was tough. In fact, so tough that you wondered if you were going to make it.
Oh, indeed. There's a point where every man comes to his breaking point on that mountain. 17,000 feet, and you prepare. Bruce and I both trained very hard for months before we went. Physical training, I had to hire a physical trainer. Bruce did, because I just don't do that stuff for fun. But it's something that I was so glad I was prepared for, because after about 4 days arriving in eastern Turkey, the summit of Ararat was socked in by weather and clouds. You just couldn't see the summit. On the fourth or fifth day, the clouds broke, the sun came out, and I saw the summit for the first time, and my heart sank, because I realized I'm fixing to have to climb this thing. It's huge. It's one of the largest land masses on Earth. Ooh. It's some 400 square miles. It's capped with permanent glaciers on top. There's many glaciers. It's got the Ahura Gorge on the north side facing Armenia. That is deeper than the Grand Canyon, about twice as deep as the Grand Canyon on that side. In 1840, an earthquake happened in that region. It set the volcano off, and it blew out what we call the Ahura Gorge. So that didn't exist prior to 1840. But the reports were that there was a structure on that mountain that everyone saw intact after 1840 when that blew out. We think it ruptured the ark in three or maybe four pieces, and that's one of the target searches that we were looking for.
But you believe it's really there. In other words, both of you are convinced that this is the place, because there have been some competing locations, right?
It is. All the evidence is pointing to Greater Ararat. Now, we understand that there's alternative locations. The one in Mount Judi or Mount Kudi in northern Iran, the Darupinar site, which is some 30 miles away across the valley. Ron Wyatt made that famous back in the 70s and 80s. He got that from a Time magazine article in 1960 and took it and kind of ran with it. There are people who still believe that. Now, we went to the Durupinar site and we looked at that. It is not Noah's Ark. Now, if it was, I would have been the first one to say, here it is, I'm planting the flag, I'm not climbing that mountain. Boys, y'all go ahead, because this is it.
Save yourself a rough trip.
That's right. But it's just not. It's been this has been debunked by independent archaeologists and geologists since the 1970s. It's simply a natural geological formation. That's all it is. But we did go there. We understand the history. We did our homework. We understand that the mountain ranges of Ararat, plural, with the scripture said it landed on the mountains of Ararat. We get it. We understand it. All the historical evidence from the time of the ancient accounts, Marco Polo and Jerome, all the way up to the 19th century, to the modern-day searches and sightings, we understand that all the evidence, including the satellite data, is pointing to Greater Ararat.
Now, these guys went up there, and on the way, they crossed nearly vertical fields of loose boulders and little pebbles. And you could lose your footing and fall literally hundreds or more feet. And they would hear in the distance the rumblings of rock slides and rock falls. And you told me you were wondering if maybe one of those would come your way. So there's ample opportunity to be afraid. You're so motivated to get up there. And when you do, you begin the work. You're up there on top of a glacier, right? Let's talk about why you went there. What were you looking for? It's just a glacier when you get to the top. You can't see an arc. What in the world are you looking for, Bruce?
Well, there's been so many sightings over the years in the ice or just sticking out of the ice. So we're looking for wood. I mean, we're looking for something that is a remnant or some type of ruin of a great ship that came to be parked there.
Tell everybody about the ice drill. Drilling through the ice with a very specialized boring machine.
Right.
And how many feet deep did you go in the ice?
On an average, about 60 feet deep. And let me just say, Aaron won't come out and say this, so I'll say it for him. He's the one who orchestrated this whole climb. The drill team had to have special equipment. He had to work with a guy named Cowboy to get it so it'll work at 17,000 feet. Not every engine works at that.
Wow.
You know, so you have to think ahead and make sure. And you know, so he worked with him. He worked with the movie team their first time over there, making sure everybody had their permits. So he really was the quarterback, if you will, to our expedition. And I give him a lot of credit because you're dealing with a lot of guys with a lot of moxie, a lot of personality.
Yeah, individuals.
And so just to get up the mountain with all the right gear so we could drill was, to me, a phenomenal feat. Then we get up there, and we ended up drilling about 40 holes, looking for some rectilinear shapes that showed up on some satellite photos.
So, you had ground-penetrating radar. I think everybody knows mm-hmm. what that is in this mm-hmm. day, this technological age. It's used to search. Usually, you'd go to an old graveyard and look for a lost grave or something like that, and you see people pulling this thing across the terrain.
Exactly.
And it's looking down through, and so you use something like that.
Yeah, instead of 6 feet, like in a graveyard, you're looking at 60 feet of ice, not even counting part of the mountain that it may be sitting in a crevasse there. So it's very difficult, extreme conditions, hard to breathe. We're getting hypoxia. It's, you know, like the worst environment you can imagine, and you're trying to pull off something that's difficult to do anyway, and that's GPR, because it doesn't give you perfect data, and you have to look through it and look through it, and that's what Dr. Bryant did.
Yeah.
His expertise, he's a PhD in geophysical.
Okay, now, in any manner you choose, tell the story of the drilling and the results of the drilling, because in a way, you found something. In another way, you were very frustrated.
That's a good way to put it. Again, Aaron leading us in all the drilling and all the GPR, putting it all together. He would say, drill in this area, drill in that area. And together is about 40 drills we made. Now, granted, it takes us about an hour and a half to 2 hours to drill one 60-foot core. Then at the time, I set up a makeshift laboratory on top in our mess tent, mm-hmm. Where we essentially did ASTM, that's American Society of Testing and Materials. The rudimentary part of the test is to heat it up and see if something is, a material is going to flow, meaning change shape. It's going to melt to some degree because the ice will melt off. The rocks won't melt, but if anything in between will change shape. And that's what we were looking for. After every drill, mm-hmm. we went through this laboratory process trying to come up with some organic material.
And I remember the part where you came up and found on the end of the drill was some kind of dark material.
Exactly.
And I'm thinking to myself, could that be, you know, I'm reading
yeah.
pitch. Could that be what's in the Bible?
And remember, it's volcanic.
Yeah.
And it's the basalt can come up as a dark material. So we were having to delineate between what is maybe a pitch, either a black type of pitch like coal tar pitch or an asphalt, or is it like a tree sap, a tree resin? So these are the parameters we're looking at. We're trying to figure it all out. And out of the 40 holes, we came up with 3 holes. We named them RB, which is after Richard Bright. Dr. Bright is the one who has been relentless about going back to the mountain and looking for Noah's Ark.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron can expound on that in a moment. But essentially, we thought we had 3. After more testing, we narrowed it down to 2 samples that are organic. And one of them, just recently, we had an expert look at it under a high-powered microscope. And he is verifying that that's wood the way he knows wood. And he is a biologist.
So, wow. But that is a big wow. because after all, this is something that we're looking for evidence. Mm-hmm. We're looking for empirical evidence. And when Bruce pulled up those samples, thank God for Bruce, because, you know, Bruce gave me a lot of credit a while ago. It really takes a team. There was people like Cowboy and others, Dr. Bryant, that was responsible for the GPR data. He would read that. We all have to triple up on a duty up there because everybody plays a vital, critical role. But Bruce found those samples. I may have overlooked them, but Bruce knew what he was looking for. And so when he's looking at these samples, you don't know what it is. But when Bruce got the samples back to the States and he's looking at it through the microscope, I mean, it is looking like this is evidence of wood fiber and maybe some
very exciting
some sap. So
what color was it? It through the microscope.
Well, I like to describe it. If you've seen the movie Jurassic Park, and if you saw the end of the cane with the mosquito in it, mm-hmm. it was covered with that tree sap. You know, do you remember that ball? Anyway, it's an amber color. As Dr. Bryant says, he's a PhD geologist. He says anything organic at that level on the mountain is very exciting. So we've seen the wood fibers. Again, we're now in the deeper stages of testing, and we can't reveal the results of that. But we do believe we have pulled off at least 16,700 feet level a piece of wood off the mountain of Ararat.
What drove you to pull all this together? How many men originally signed up to go, and how many got to the top of the mountain?
We had probably 20 originally on the dig crew, and then we had the film crew, which is probably another 20 people. We had people in and out, coming and going. Probably only 40% of either team made it up to the summit of Ararat. Now, some people made it in different stages at some of the higher camps, but not everyone summited. We anticipated that. We mm-hmm. have to have a plan B, if you will, in case somebody doesn't make it to the top. So we anticipated those problems. Logistically, it's a huge expedition to put together. We got to the top, and, you know, we had some, I don't know, 40 cases of, you know, our equipment and then scientific, you know, equipment that had to get to the top.
And all that drilling equipment.
And all the drilling equipment, the GPR, all that has to be carried to the generators, the fuel, all that has to be taken to the top. So we couldn't have done it, by ourselves. The local Kurds and the guides helped us get all that to the top. But it was.
You were propelled to do this thing. What was propelling you? What was providing the motivation? When I think about climbing up 3,000-4,000 feet of, yeah. of loose rock, forget that.
right. Well, you know, as I said earlier, there was a point where I just nearly gave up. You'll see me slowing down. I'm in the big red jacket, and I'm just, you know, I actually stopped because I was so nauseated. The altitude, we was probably at around 15,500 or 16,000 feet, but for the first time, the altitude hit. And I just thought, I don't know if I can do this. I really don't know. And I considered just quitting. And I turned around. It was about 6 in the morning. We started at about, I don't know, about 3 in the morning mm-hmm. climbing. You have headlamps, and you just put one foot in front of the other, and you go. About 6 in the morning, I turned around. The guys, Bill and Will Hughes, were the advanced team going up. And they said, Aaron, turn around. I turned around, and on the valley floor was the shadow of Mount Ararat.
Wow.
And as the sun was rising up in the east, it casted this beautiful shadow on the valley floor. It was miles wide. And you'll see it in the film. I've got it in the journal, a picture of it. I turned around, and I saw that, and I looked down, and I thought, wow, look at that shadow. Look at where you're at. You're on Mount Ararat. You have just a little ways to go. And the guys were encouraging me, Aaron, you're almost there. You're almost there. Those guys could have outclimbed me. They could have outpaced me easily, but they didn't. They said, we're going to go with you, and we're all going to make it to the top. Hmm. There was a point where I realized I had to reach down deeper than I ever have in my life. And I just prayed. I said, Lord, I can't do this by myself. I have to have help. And those men said, we're with you. we're all going to make it. And there was a lesson I learned in that. Sometimes it's easy to give up. It's easy to give up on the mountains in your life. You don't want to climb it. It's easier to go the other way.
Sure.
And just to quit. The hard thing to do is to keep going. The hard thing to do is not give up. And I realized if I gave up, I'd have to go back home. I'd miss everything that Bruce and the guys were doing up on the summit. After all, I was here for a mission. I was here for a purpose.
Yeah.
That purpose wasn't for me. That was a purpose greater than myself or any one of us. And that was the search for this ark.
You know, and to me, the purpose is to reveal the truth of biblical history.
Yes.
A testimony of the living God for the whole world to see. Now, apparently, it's not quite time to reveal that yet. What's your thinking on that, Bruce?
In God's time, it will be revealed. We're just trying to do our part and be diligent about searching.
You know, when I hear these guys talk, what I'm hearing is a testimony of faith in God, really. Without a deep and abiding faith in the Word of God, the presence of God, you probably wouldn't have tried this, right?
No way.
You know, you asked a while ago, Gary, if you know, we all believe the ark is real. Do I have to find that ark to believe it? No, I don't. For some, they require evidence. And for those people, it may sway them. It may change them. Because after all, you know, it's not, you know, if we find it, it's when we find it. And I think when we find it, it will be a testimony frozen in time. As a testimony to the world that, yes, this event actually occurred. This is a pre-flood artifact that still may exist in the book of Genesis. And it served a purpose. That purpose was to save 8 people and the animals on a floating life support vessel called the Ark.
And it really happened.
And it really happened.